Initially, I just want to say welcome to everyone and thank you for coming along and joining in. As you said, Vanessa, it's a great topic. It brings a smile to my face. I don't know. I love talking and thinking about menopause and thinking about this phase of my life and seeking more knowledge around it. And that was what really, you know, inspired me in my master's in health psychology a couple of years ago to do global research studies on menopause and specifically lifestyle habits and things, which I'll get into in a bit. But we'd really love you to get the most that you can around your personal journey with menopause, because it is a universal thing for almost all women, but it's so personal. And that's what makes it really quite tricky in some ways, and why we really need a team. We need a well-being team around us, and that's what you have today. So please do make sure you tap into the resources on that front. So without further ado, I think what we're going to do is get into the questions and get into the nitty-gritty, shall we say. And so the first question up is, I don't know whether to change it around. I don't know. Or whether I'll go first, because I've said that I'll go first. So that we'll stick to the agenda. So basically, as I said, I'm the health habits coach. And my first, the question I've put to answer really is around the lifestyle habits that can really be impactful for a woman in her menopause journey. And as I said, I did a specific postgraduate research in this space. And so I've got three key habit areas to focus on. The first is exercise. My one systematic review I did was on the impact of exercise on sleep during menopause. Now, sleep is the second biggest, most common symptom that is, you know, impacted negatively for women during their menopause. It can be up to 83% of women experiencing things like insomnia, restless legs, different conditions. But perimenopause and that first part is typically insomnia is the most commonly experienced issue, problem. And the research that I did, it was a global study, hundreds and hundreds of hours of the stuff. And basically, in a nutshell, that exercise beat out everything. It beat out HRT. Again, not huge amounts of research. So, you know, I always want to caveat with that. But exercise did beat out everything else in terms of in these RCT trials as to what was the most effective treatment for sleeplessness and insomnia in perimenopause. And the thing to be really, I think, quite excited about was it actually beat out, in a couple of RCTs, sleeping pills. And so so what I then dived into was, well, what exercise, you know? And I always say any exercise is good exercise, because it's true. But in terms of the research and the stats, the most bang for buck you're going to get is vigorous and strength training. And that's really looking at building muscles and strength. And also the other end of the spectrum, you'll get a lot if you've got insomnia, which is often related to stress, mind, body. So yoga, we're going to be hearing from Monica. So yoga and, you know, Qigong, those featured really, really strongly in the research as being very powerful ways of reducing insomnia. As did sort of, if you could add in some meditation along with your yoga, that was like double bubble. So really focusing on your exercise in menopause, there's many, many added benefits that we all know, but specific to menopause, really helps with the gut health, helps strength the core, which Jeanette's going to be talking about. But exercise really helps with the core and the actual, our gut health, the structure of our internal sort of gut and pelvic floor, which really helps the whole system of health. And obviously exercise for osteoporosis and prevention of that, and that coming into play in this phase of women's lives. And then moving on to second one is diet and some key sort of dietary habits, if you like, that can really become very beneficial for many women with common menopause symptoms. And really, we've got to talk about two kind of, what should I have less of? What should I have more of? The more of, let's do that, because that'll be no-brainers, really. Green leafy vegetables, you know, particularly focusing on also on protein, to that strength training. So if you can combine that exercise with more protein and the green leafy vegetables, lots of fiber. I call it my big three. So it's protein, fiber, healthy fats. You get those going more in your diet. They are going to feed that gut health. That gut health is so important, because autoimmune conditions for women, it increased by 80% over the age of 40. And the research is suggesting that it's a lot to do with our gut health, and it's a lot to do with leaky gut. And so the more we can focus our dietary behaviors that will be good for gut health, the more we will likely reduce those menopause symptoms. On the negative side of what have I got to let go of, it's alcohol, sugar. I should say sugar first, really. I am a type 2 diabetes health coach. Sugar and alcohol, plus caffeine if it's insomnia, right? So basically those are the main types of foods that will be very inflammatory for your gut and for those hot flashes. The relationship between sugar and alcohol and hot flashes is very strong, very strongly correlated, as is caffeine. And then finally, third section is your sort of your stress, your self-care. And so really, it does become the menopause journey. It's one of the hardest phases. And this is where a lot of my research focused on, is how we have a trifecta around women's health. And so, yeah, it's difficult. We're often caregivers of kids, caregivers of parents. We look different. We've got identity shifts, peaks in our careers. There's a lot going on. And so really, we have to start prioritizing our self-care practices. Learn how to rest for you as an individual, and learn how to rejuvenate your energy levels so that you can manage that big landscape. So that's kind of it. I don't know if now open it up. Any questions or any thoughts, any inputs on that general lifestyle stuff?
It's very interesting what you are saying about lifestyle, because within my approach, I do focus on lifestyle approaches. And one would be surprised, thinking I'm a psychologist, what have I got to do with lifestyle? But aside of being a psychologist, I'm also a lifestyle medicine practitioner. So I'm very passionate about adjusting lifestyle to support health and well-being. And there is plenty of research suggesting that there is a correlation between lifestyle, meaning diet, movement, sleep, how we rest, how we play, how we connect, how we manage our stress. All those factors are very closely correlated with the severity of our symptoms in menopause. So in terms of bringing psychology to the table to support lifestyle changes, I use a lot of behavioral tools, because as a psychologist, I'm specialized in cognitive behavioral therapy. So the behavioral part of CBT comes in very handy to support that kind of behavioral change. So I do appreciate greatly what you're doing, because I believe it's very important dimension to be tackled and to be addressed for women going through the menopause, to regain their emotional and physical well-being over and above using HRT, if they choose to use that, or if they don't, then behavioral changes are the second option that needs to be considered.
Yeah, absolutely. And we can't stay as islands, no matter how good we are, because a woman isn't dealing with a singular symptom. Menopause is a journey. It's a landscape. So absolutely, and that's what's the beauty of collaborations like this event, so that we can all appreciate different perspectives, different knowledge bases, and bring that in when we're helping those in our space. Rosie, sorry, I can see your hand raised.
Quick question. If you've not been doing all those things, how easy is it to reverse the process if you sort of, you know, you come to the table late, so to speak?
Oh, that's a great question. I love it. You do know the oldest, you don't know, but the oldest participant or person in my coaching groups, I've coached a couple of thousand, it was 93. And as I say, never too late, never too old, never too late.
Still menopausal, was she?
Well, no, but lifestyle isn't really. I mean, I gave targeted comments around the research to do with menopause, but you could, that healthy diet is a healthy diet. It's not,
yes,
you know. So there's standardized things, and then there's specific individuals with specific symptoms and specific landscapes. And that's why the more we get into the nitty gritty in the wood and the trees, the more that we can, yeah, help target that individual's needs.
So it's like the basis is the same, and then you add things on, like sort of almost like a shopping list for the individual needs of different people.
Yeah, it's biohacking, or you know, it's a bit of that, really, a bit of trial and error, but paying attention to the cause and effects of the different attempts of the different lifestyle habits, and which ones are really working for you and which ones aren't. But I better move on to Hannah, who's got her hand raised. Hi.
Yeah, I was just going to say that actually we're talking about menopause in this context, but it's important to look at post-menopause as well. And a lot of women have concerns about things like developing dementia and osteoporosis and all that kind of stuff. And we're being told constantly that the only way to protect ourselves from that is really to top up with hormones. But in actual fact, there's quite robust research for the lifestyle changes that you recommend, things like getting daily exercise. If you look on, I think it's the Dementia UK website, it talks about something like 14 studies that prove that 30 minutes exercise a day cuts your risk of dementia by 30 to 45%. Now, that research is out there, but we're not told about it. So it's just another perspective on what else we can do besides topping up hormones to prevent things like that, or help reduce the risk of things like that developing later in life. So, you know, look, it's just, we need to get that out there a little bit more, I think. And it's a shame we wait till we reach perimenopause and it starts to get difficult for us before we begin to implement these changes. But that's humans, isn't it? You know, we don't sort of deal with a problem unless it becomes too big a problem for us to ignore anymore. And it's, maybe it's a golden opportunity to get our health right, probably for the first time in our lives.
Yeah, definitely. I think you raise a really good point. That there's it's not this cut and dried thing. I mean, there's certain specific things that start to happen during menopause journey and perimenopause, but you know, it's not this, I'm this, and then I, you know, who can think of themselves in their 20s, their 30s, their 40s, and so on? Like, we're just one person traveling through our life. We're not this segmented thing. And I think you raise really good points. But I do want to make sure that you all get your time. So I'm going to, we can circle back onto any particular specifics in that Q&A at the end. But leaning into Hannah next. And so actually, if you could answer this question that we have, which is around the ways in which herbal medicine can help support a woman in her menopause journey.
Thank you. It's my favourite topic, so I will try and stick to 5 or so minutes. I should probably start by explaining a bit more about what herbal medicine is, because many of us have heard of Chinese herbal medicine or perhaps Ayurveda, but we do have a tradition of using Western herbal medicine as well. I'm not quite sure where everyone is, but obviously I'm in the UK and we have a strong tradition here, although it's a broken tradition for various reasons that I don't have time to go into right now. But wherever you are in the world, there will be a tradition of herbal medicine native to that part of the world. And in a nutshell, herbal medicine is making medicine from plants. And there's lots of different ways that we can do that. So if you've ever had a chamomile tea, you've had herbal medicine. And there's two real main ways you can take it. So you can go to the garden centre and buy some plants for your garden, and then you can pick them and make them into teas or whatever it is you want. Or you could go to a shop or go online and get some herbal remedies. That way, if you're not kind of glued up on which herbs to use when, can get really good results occasionally, but can also be a massive waste of time and money. So the other way to take herbs is to see someone like me who will really assess you and your needs thoroughly and then prescribe the herbs specifically for you. So I've got about just over 100 herbs in my dispensary downstairs. I wanted to show you this. I've just got this delivered by my son, who you probably noticed gate crashed our meeting for a moment. But this is a baby ashwagandha. So I try to kind of get as hands-on with the herbs as I can. I don't just use bottles of brown liquid. But ashwagandha is a really useful herb as an adaptogen in perimenopause, which you may or may not have heard of. So again, we're told that menopause is a new invention and it's not been around very long. And previously we would have died before we reached menopause age, which was true in many cases. But there were women who did actually survive well into their 80s, 70s, 80s, maybe even 90s. And if those ladies had issues with their menopause, they would have used herbs, like we used herbs for all health issues. And there was a famous Austrian medieval herbalist called Hildegard von Bingen, and she talks about using herbs for menopause in her texts. So this is not a new thing. It's every bit as relevant today as it always has been. And it offers a really lovely, gentle way, not just to help you through your menopause, but to help protect your health long term, but also to reconnect with nature, with the environment. And it does something on a very deep level that I can't quite describe. But you really notice it, particularly if you get hands on with making your own medicines. And I do try and encourage patients to do that wherever possible. It's a very grounding, life affirming thing to use. So in my practice, we use herbal medicine to help women through menopause, whatever's going on for them. And I see menopause in the context of a woman's overall health. So I'm not just looking at menopause and I'm not just saying we'll take that herb for that symptom. It's much, much deeper than that. And very often we can see patterns that go back perhaps decades that have led up to this point. And it's clear why this particular lady sat in front of me is having these particular issues with her menopause. Over here in the West, it's quite common for women to have quite debilitating sometimes menopause symptoms. Over in Asia, though, less so. And there's various different reasons for that. So the lifestyle is different, the diet is different, but also the attitude towards menopause and aging and even death is much more positive than we have here in the West. So we're looking at you as a whole person. We're looking at the physical symptoms first and foremost, but we are also looking at the psycho-emotional aspects and the spiritual aspects as well. And then we use the herbs to sort of tweak and nudge your body back towards behaving normally, if you like, because I trust your body can do menopause like it's done everything else. It's done every other transition so far, and you've lived to tell the tale. But usually by the time we reach perimenopause, we're on a back foot because we're chronically overstressed, overtired, undernourished, underexercised, and we just don't have those resources that we need to get us through gently. So the herbs kind of try and undo that a little bit and remind your body how to function normally. So the majority of the herbs that I use in my clinic are in tincture form, and tinctures are a preparation that we make from alcohol and water that we steep the herbs in. And that way we get a very rounded effect, because we're using the alcohol to take some of the constituents from the herb and the water takes the others. So we mix together about 6 or 7 different herbal tinctures into one bottle, and that does the background work. So that's helping with hormone balance. We can help with things like reducing inflammation, improving gut health, improving liver clearance of old hormones. We can also help buffer the effects of long-term stress, because we're all suffering stress in one way or another. And it does have an action on the body. So we all know that if, for example, we're very stressed, we might miss a period, or a period, our cycle might just mess itself up. And I think that's a very clever primeval mechanism, because our inner cave woman is perceiving that we're in danger. And it doesn't make sense to fall pregnant if you're in danger, does it? So it will disrupt your reproductive cycle. And that's a very clever mechanism, but it's not terribly helpful in this day and age where we're chronically under stress. So we use herbs to help buffer the effects of stress on our whole body and on our hormones in particular. And then we have other herbs that we can use for specific symptoms. So if you're having terrible hot flushes, we've got herbs that will help with that. If you've got brain fog or palpitations or aches and pains or anything else, we can use specific herbs. So I've got a lovely little fly visitor, keeps going into my face. So we're building it from the bottom up. We're dealing with the deep underlying causes, but we're dealing with the individual symptoms as well. And you get to choose where we begin in terms of the symptoms if you've got a lot going on. So it's a very versatile, very patient-centered way of working. So you're in charge of your own treatment, and then that puts you a bit more back in control of your body and what your body's doing. And it can work really, really quickly. And I do also take into account other health conditions you have and any other medication you're taking as well. So it's completely safe. And believe it or not, that's why medical herbalists are not regulated in the UK, because our safety record is too good to justify the cost and the trouble of being regulated. So there you go.
Brilliant. I love it. Not just because in a previous life I was I've got like landscape gardening, and I did, and I was a flower farmer and I had a farmer's market stall, and I used to grow, had a little herbal patch. So nothing on your level, Hannah, but I just love hearing about it and love seeing the ashwagandha. They offered me a lot of money for that in this trendy coffee shop in Soho in New York City in 2017, because it was all the new thing to add herbs to, okay, to you know, before the matcha latte took over. I think it's fascinating. And I'm just wondering about, you mentioned about the whole like holistic. And so is there a lot of questions you ask that go beyond? Is it quite a consultation that happens if somebody came to meet you to try and get help from you?
Yeah, it's at least an hour long. We go through as much as we can in that time. So it really depends on the patient, because she might want to focus on one particular thing. Sometimes we don't really get around to talking about the physical stuff so much, because if there's a lot of stress going on, a lot of trauma and, you know, psycho-emotional stuff coming up, then that's where the conversation goes, and we kind of delve into the physical symptoms as we go along. So we get at least the basic safety stuff done in the first consultation, and then at least we can get one herbal prescription underway safely. It's all very much playing it by ear and just seeing what comes up at the time.
It's wonderful. I imagine there's quite a community, and like I'm just thinking about the links with women's health and historically and women's health research. And of course, up until 300 years ago, women were the healers. We were the medics, we were the doctors. And yeah, then it all got kind of white coated, and particularly in the Victorian era. And that side of women's health history is fascinating to me. And do you find that around, that you have quite a strong community of sharing, and it's just a natural space to share and collaborate knowledge?
Yeah, it is. I mean, the herbal community, it's very hard to describe what it's like to be a herbalist and be around other herbalists, because they are the kindest, loveliest souls, but they're a very eclectic bunch. So at one end of the scale, we've got the very medical reductionist herbalists who are very into the science and all of that. That's really interesting. And then we've got the very esoteric, shamanic end of the scale as well. And I try and sit somewhere in the middle. But it's a lovely way to help people reconnect with nature and reconnect with each other, and just see that actually although we feel different, and we feel, you know, menopause is a very unique journey to each woman, but we're all one as well. So and we're at one with nature. And, you know, you do notice things like you can't get hold of certain herbs at certain times of the year, because if you're at the wrong end of the year after the harvest, the stock is gone and you need to start using something else, and that's okay. So yeah, it's a lovely way of working.
Monica, do you want to?
Yeah, I have. Oh, Sorry, I've unmuted myself. Okay, so Hannah, I love every word that came out of your mouth.
Oh, thank you.
I'd love to, actually, I feel like we need to talk and talk about it. You know, so many things you touched on, including this idea that, you know, it's women in the West who tend to have a lot of these symptoms the most, as opposed to the East. And there's great work done by anthropologists that demonstrate this, but I'm not going to go into that. What mm-hmm. I wanted to know is, even if somebody doesn't do a consultation with you, is there anything you would recommend for women sort of going on the journey in perimenopause or menopause that they should take? So we know from Claire that, you know, we should be eating the leafy greens, eating the fiber and the good fats. What about in terms of herbs, like even things like I studied a lot of Ayurveda, and I remember learning, for example, that aloe vera is very high in phytoestrogens. You know, is that something, you know, that maybe after a certain age, all women should be taking? I'm using that as an example, right? Or are we just all simply too bio-individual or is it like an ashwagandha? I'm just curious if there's a general recommendation.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to kind of go into, really, but I mean, I always say there's no point taking the herbs if your diet and lifestyle is up the wall. And it's partly why I started introducing coaching as well into my practice a while ago. So I would say always start wherever you are, always start with getting those basics of diet and lifestyle in place. And actually, that's what they do in other parts of the world. The Chinese herbalists do that, and the Ayurvedic as well. So get your diet and lifestyle. That's the very basis. That's your foundation stone, if you like. And then there are certain herbs which pretty much everyone can take and feel the benefits of, and they're not going to interact with other stuff. And, you know, and it's typically the herbs that you'd find in your food or in your local cafe, things like peppermint tea, lemon balm, fennel, those kinds of things are pretty safe and straightforward. But, you know, where it gets complicated is things like if it's menopause on top of multiple other health issues with multiple medications, then it can get tricky. So, you know, if in doubt, I'm sure we'll put my contact details somewhere and people can always just give me a shout and I'll help as best I can.
Thanks so much, Hannah. That is really great. And yeah, just to reiterate to anybody listening that, you know, when we are talking, if there's a crossover or a space that is crossing over with medical views, and obviously do speak with your healthcare professional, your own provider, or with, in the case of, you know, sort of medications, your pharmacist. And they can give you a sense of what's appropriate action for you to take. So next expert, it's time for Simona. And so I'm going to ask this question, and that is, why do women experience mental health difficulties during the perimenopause and menopause journey? And what can they do to feel mentally, you know, sort of more resilient?
Right. This is a very broad question, but I always want to start with this point that everyone thinks that menopause is something related to our ovaries. Now, although obviously ovaries are producing our estrogen, that's so important for our physical and mental health, estrogen is having a massive impact on the brain. So because of the relationship between the ovaries and the brain, you know, it's just inevitable for our mental health sometimes to struggle when estrogen levels fluctuate and ultimately decrease in quite a significant way. So we really need to understand that menopause, it's a neurological transition. And there are studies that are showing that basically the brain, the organ that's in our skull is changing during the perimenopause, and it's going through a period of adaptation. And there are changes in glucose metabolism of the brain. There are changes in gray matter volume. There are many other changes in connectivity between different parts of the brain because of the changes in hormone levels, because of the changes in estrogen and progesterone, may I say. So ultimately, because the organ is impacted, we are possibly, potentially going to notice changes in how we think, how we feel, and how we behave. It's as if, you know, just think, if you are drinking alcohol, it's affecting your brain, and therefore you think differently, feel differently, and behave differently. So obviously with our hormones, it's not like with alcohol as such, but because of the changes of hormone levels, the organ itself is going to be impacted, and that's going to lead to potential mental health difficulties. Now, we know that mental health problems are experienced on a spectrum. Something like 20% of women, they will experience very mild, if any, symptoms related to menopausal transition, I mean, emotional difficulties, while 60% of women would experience just more mild to moderate difficulties. But a very small percentage of women can experience severe mental health problems that sometimes can lead to even psychotic disorder. You might have heard about women after they give birth that they have a psychotic episode. And in the same way, like women after giving birth, because of the changes in hormone levels, they experience this postpartum psychosis, as it's called. In menopause, some women can be very vulnerable to develop this type of psychotic presentation that's driven by hormones. But ultimately, I want to think about mental health not only being due to hormones. Like Hannah was saying, I think we are human beings that we are impacted by so many other factors. So when I think about the severity of mental health problems, I always think about three main categories that I need to assess when I see anyone, but also I would like every woman to think about their symptoms in the light of these three big categories. The first category that we need to think about, it's our body. We need to understand what's happening in our body. So obviously, at one level, there can be something about genetics. If you are looking at how your mother, your grandmother, sister is experiencing menopause, perimenopause, or any other hormonal changes throughout the life, that might give you a bit of an inkling that there are certain genetic predispositions there. But genes are not destiny, because our genes are switched on and off by our environment. And when I talk about the environment, we need to think about what we eat, how we sleep, how we move. All of those factors are potentially switching on and off certain gene predispositions that we have there. So for that reason, we need to think about our body. We need to think that, yes, we might have certain gene predisposition, but ultimately, there is a lot that we can do, even with this predisposition, that sometimes might not necessarily stack up in our favor. There are things that we can do. And then when we think about this big category of the body, we need to think also about the hormones. Obviously, the menopause, it's a body-based kind of transition. So hormones are driving that process to a degree. But over and above that, we already spoken about nutrition, about the sleep, about rest, about movement that are crucial in terms of nurturing our body. Because when our nutrition is suffering, when we are leading a sedentary lifestyle, when we take our sleep for granted, or we cannot sleep for that matter, those kind of behaviors are going to impact on the severity of our symptoms. So putting aside this big bucket of the body, as I call it, we need to think of the second bucket, which is the mind. So when we think of the mind, we need to think of all those things that are related to the way we think. So negative thinking styles, mindsets that maybe are not always necessarily very helpful, are increasing our vulnerability to experience much more severe menopausal symptoms. But also we know that there is a vulnerability of having more serious mental health difficulties during the menopause if we had a past history of mental health difficulties. It's almost like mental health difficulties in the past, they are setting the scene for us maybe to be much more vulnerable to develop again difficulties. So we need to keep an eye on that. And we know that if we had those issues in the past, maybe we need to be on a lookout and seek support at an earlier stage. And then we need to think in this mind bucket about our emotional resilience. Like, what's our ability to manage our emotions, or how we would call it in jargon, how do we emotionally regulate? Because that's very important. And emotional regulation, it's a skill. Sometimes we learn that as we mature. Sometimes we're not very good at learning that. It's almost like, if I feel in a certain way, I'm going to show it, or I'm going to push it down, I'm going to express it. So for that reason, it's important to learn to emotionally regulate. And last and not least, in this big category of the mind factors, we need to think about how we find joy and purpose in life, and how do we feel fulfilled. Because when we don't feel fulfilled, inevitably, that's going to affect our mental health, and it's going to affect how we feel, how we think, and that it's going to drive down into our body and increase the severity of our symptoms. So there is the second bucket. The third bucket is the life that we are living, the environment, the context that we are living our life. There we need to think about stress. And stress is an absolute huge topic, and Hannah has touched on that. And, you know, what I want to say about stress as well, actually, last month, a very new study came out, published by a neuroscientist, Lisa Mosconi, which is a colossus in this field of menopause and mental health. And she has published this study showing that cortisol levels, which are driven by stress, are closely related to propensity of developing Alzheimer's. So like you said, Hannah, it's not just about hormones. Obviously, hormones play a part there. We need to consider them if that's something that is not contraindicated for us, or we are open to consider. But ultimately, we do need to think about managing our stress, because stress plays such a big role in our health and well-being per se, but also in developing potentially Alzheimer's. So there is the need to think about stress. Then we need to think about the quality of our relationships. And there, in this category, we need to think about quality of our relationship with ourselves in the first instance, relationship with our loved ones, with our partners, and then relationship with the world. And there we really need to look at how do we build up much more conducive relationships. So these are the three categories of factors that contribute to the severity of symptoms. So for that reason, we cannot really just zoom into the hormones. And when someone is coming to see me, for example, and they say, oh, I just need my hormones, I don't know why my doctor recommended me to see a psychologist, I just explain exactly like I explained to you, that are all these three big categories with many other factors that collude into creating really the symptoms that we are presenting. So then when we come to address these problems and to help women feel better, we really need to address all three categories. We need to look at how we rebalance the body, and that can be done through nutrition, movement, hormones, if that's something that one would consider. But also we need to rebalance the body through managing our body energy budget, as I call it. So how do we learn to really listen to our body when it's going down, when it's depleted, and how we top up our energy through sleep, through movement, through all those things that we have mentioned. Then we need to look at how do we address the mind. And there we will learn different strategies to interfere with that negative mind chatter that many of us can experience. And then we need to think about emotional regulation. How do we make friends with all emotions? We can't just say, I want to be friends with happiness. We really need to make friends with all the emotions that we experience, because only then we can really respond to them differently. And last but not least, we really need to deal with stress and also build up a strong connection and network around us and strong connection with nature in order to be able to rebalance our health and well-being during the menopause. So this is just a snapshot of what I would do. And on a basis of this principle, I developed a model that's called EMBERS, which really encapsulates the six stages that I believe are essential to attend to in order to help women regain their health and well-being during the menopause. So, don't know. Any questions? Happy to answer.
Oh, I thank you so much, Simona. That was really exhaustive. But then, you know, we psychology professionals,
I would say,
have so many details. It's just the hardest thing for a the hardest question to ask a psychology professional is, you know, what's your favorite ex? Mm. Like, we just, you know, it's all about context. Mm. And so, well, I think that really encapsulated it. But in order to give everybody else their sort of their time, I'm going to move on to the next expert. But thank you so, so much. And obviously, any questions can be addressed in the Q&A in a few minutes. So onwards to Jeanette, our wonderful Core Restore expert, pelvic floors. Now we're getting into the real, the heart and like onto the tough subjects here, I feel, Jeanette. And so here's the question. What are the most effective pelvic floor exercises? But maybe if you could give us a little bit of your community, the women you help, what they're struggling with, what makes it a little bit of a tough subject to be openly chatting about?
Well, thank you, Claire, and welcome everybody to this amazing event. I'm very happy to be here. And this is a subject that most women would rather stick their head in the sand rather than talk about it, even with their friends, because when it comes to pelvic floor issues, we're embarrassed and we don't want to talk about it. And in our generation, when we were growing up, when it came to pelvic floor health, I mean, especially, you know, after you had given birth, your only examination was a 6-week prod on the belly to make sure your uterus had gone back to the place that it was supposed to be. And then you're told to go ahead and do carry on as you were. But the trauma that happens to the pelvic floor and the vaginal canal after childbirth is pretty huge, and we need a little more time and we need better strategies in place to help us to be able to laugh, cough, sneeze and jump without leaking. But it is embarrassing. And, you know, I was always quite horrified when I had to go and tell my personal story, which involved leaking. I never told anybody either. I didn't. I was like, I can't tell people. I'm not going to tell people like that. It's horrifying because you feel like you're on the decline. And you just don't want to admit it. It's just something that, and it's funny because even though we've all got a pelvic floor, it's the most underserved part of the body. And because it's not seen, everybody's like, oh, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to tell you that. So it is funny, the stigma that is associated with it. But I'm in quite a few friend groups and nobody comes out in our circle and says, Jeanette, you know, this is what's going on. They sort of come quietly to me and let me know rather than sharing it amongst each other, which I always find amusing. But it is, our pelvic health is evolving. It is being talked about more, especially the last couple of years. I believe that pelvic floor issues are being talked about more, which is good. And it's not like it's something that we're only just experiencing, but now we're actually talking about it. And we want to have different strategies and methods, something better that rather than surgery alone, which may fix the problem right now, but down the road, the symptoms usually come back if you're relying just on a surgical approach. And I'm not knocking anybody that has had to have pelvic surgeries, because sometimes that's the only route that you have available to you. But there are still things that you can do which will help your success rates of surgery. And before I go on to the best exercise to do, I want to talk about the ones which not to do. The old-fashioned Kegels. I mean, I don't know if we've all stood. I know I have. I've stood at the bus stop and I'm like, oh, I'm squeezing my pelvic floor. I'm squeezing those poor little muscles at the bottom, which we believe are going to be fully responsible for keeping everything in place. It's like, yes, I'm squeezing. This is great. You know, very, very time efficient. But the problem with Kegels, there's many, but the main problem with Kegels is that just squeezing the external holes at the bottom of the pelvic floor can produce more problems, because you are then using that small little muscle so much that it becomes super tight, which can actually exacerbate your problems and issues. We have to look at what's going on above. We've got to look at the diaphragm. We've got to look at the core system. We've got to look at your posture. One of my little annoyances in the world is the development of, there's different names for it. One of, they call it the Imsala chair, the pelvic throne. It is this chair that you sit on, and it shoots electrodes in the pelvic floor while you sit on it. But the problem is, for most of us, when you're sitting, we're sitting and we're rounded shoulders, we sort of hunched with the head is forward, but our pelvic floor reacts better with our breathing and our posture. So to sit on a chair which is giving you electrodes which tighten your pelvic floor. We all love to have a tight pelvic floor, even though that's not what we want. But everybody wants a tight pelvic floor so they feel like they can sit on this chair, get those exercises done, and then off you go to the shops and everything's going to be fine. But the problem is 80% of women, 80% of women's pelvic floor is already too tight. We need it to be a flexible support. So you can laugh, cough, sneeze, exercise without anything happening, without having to wear a pad. And in today's society, pharmaceutical companies are making their underwear or pads more slender. Oh, but a different color. You can get a nice lacy black one. So they're really preying on our quick fix. You know, it's like, yes, your stress level may be reduced because you're wearing a pad, but it's because you know that nobody's going to notice. It's not solving the problem. So another one of my little annoyances is with the pharmaceutical companies and the way that they're pushing those disposable pads, you know, the full incontinence underwear, which, yes, there is a market for that. But in our generation, I believe that there are, and there actually are, other and better things that we can do to reduce our leaks rather than wearing a pad just in case, which does take down the stress level. But let's be honest, nobody really wants to wear a pad. And surely one of the benefits of menopause is not needing those products anymore. You know, we don't need that tampon-like device, and we don't need that pad just in case. So Kegels are a problem, but the good thing about it, we're talking about it more, there is a new method. I'm going to say new because many women haven't heard of this word before. It's called hypopressives. It's a system which is based on your whole postural core system. It's not just those poor little muscles at the bottom being responsible for everything. It's a core and pelvic floor restoration system, and it has a lot to do with your breathing, it has a lot to do with your posture, and it will give you, it's a system that provides you exercises to do which will relieve symptoms of prolapse, leaks, urgency, and it will help you improve your success rate of surgery. So I've found this method because of my own incontinence issues. I like football, that's soccer, for those of you watching the US and Canada. I jumped out of a chair when England scored a goal, because I'm from Wales, but Wales didn't make the championship. Anyway, I jumped out of my chair and I leaped. I was like, oh my God, this is terrible. So anyway, I discovered the hypopressive method for my own journey because I wanted to find a natural solution. And the thing is, even though we're going through menopause, yes, there's hormonal changes. Vaginal dryness is another one as well. But there are exercises that we can do to help reduce these symptoms and help us to live a better life without relying on pads, surgery, devices and things like that. So I developed the online program, the Core Restore Method, and it does help with reducing the symptoms of prolapse. And prolapse could be something like feeling a heaviness in the underwear. You know, maybe by lunchtime you want to get off your feet because you're feeling that heavy pressure. And the method takes the pressure off the pelvic floor. It actually draws the abdominal wall together. Like, my background is in Pilates as well, but there's some Pilates moves that I don't do anymore because they don't make sense and some of them are silly. I won't go into that, but I believe in functional movement, being able to get off the floor properly, you know, full body strength, posture, breathing. And Kegels aren't the answer. And even though you have to have surgery, there's still things that you can do to improve your success rate. So leaving, if you just have the surgery and you don't do your pelvic floor exercises, it's like going to the dentist to have your teeth cleaned, but not brushing your teeth yourself. You still need to be proactive in doing your pelvic floor exercises. And I use the hypopressive method in the program with post-rehab Pilates. Not all Pilates, because some of it is a little... However, I discovered the hypopressive method, and that has been a game changer in relieving symptoms of leaks, prolapse, and improving the success rate of surgeries, whether that's hernia, hysterectomy, because I know many women who have... had the surgery, the mesh for the bladder. They put a mesh there to support the bladder. And one of my clients was, or is, I shouldn't say was, she is a medical doctor. And she came to me 5 years after having the mesh inserted because it stopped working. And not only did it stop working, because she relied on this solution, she stopped doing core work, she stopped doing pelvic floor work, and she felt and looked like she was 4 months pregnant. And it was so hard for her because she had gone through the psychological effects of surgery, and she had come out of it feeling like that was the answer to her problems, and 5 years later they returned. So it's important to find other strategies like the hypopressive method, which helps. It's not just about those poor little muscles at the bottom. Just squeezing those is not the answer. We need to look at more than that. We need to look at the whole core system, the way that you sit, you stand, the way that you breathe has a huge impact on your pelvic floor. So it's not those little squeezing things that we, you might have all started doing it as I started talking about it.
That's so funny. Thank you so, so much. I, Jeanette, like, I just really, I love hearing from such a wide variety of experts, and we're hearing about sort of concept stuff, but then we're into the real heart and, like, you know, just real life, real health experiences for many, many, many women in them as part of their menopause journey. And to hear that this isn't, don't accept it. Like, A, that many other women are going through it, but also you don't need to accept it. And so I really, really appreciate that. And I didn't say at the beginning, I'm ever so sorry, but just to reiterate that we will be making sure everybody has contacts and everybody understands, you know, how to get hold of each of the experts at the end. But yeah, so thank you so, so much. And actually, you kind of brought it full circle and tied in really lovely to segue into Monica. And as Monica, very central, talking about core and breath and body, and it's a system. And so, but from a different perspective and a different, you know, a different kind of person is probably going to come to you, Monica, with their, you know, health, you know, sort of needs in terms of support. compared to Jeanette, maybe. So, but the question that we've got for you yourself is, can you explain how resetting the nervous system can help ease menopause symptoms, and what any specific techniques or practices that are most effective for achieving this?
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I'd love to. So, you know, I'm standing in before you actually in my yoga therapist training now. I work with many executives. I do training programs actually on resilience a lot of the time. And the nervous system comes up, and it's very interesting. I actually just did a talk to a group of 500 women on this, because often we talk about stress, right? In the middle years, not just for women, but for men too, hormones aside, are extremely stressful. You know, we've been talking about how, you know, all these, you know, kind of like raise your hand if you're looking after kids and elderly parents and have a big job and have multiple things, you know, coming at you, right? So learning how to reset our nervous system and calm our nervous system is really, really critical. And I work with people who are really, really busy and say, I don't have time. So, you know, how do we do that and create it as a way of being, right? How do we do it over and over again so that we don't have a lot of these symptoms, right? We often overlook the nervous system as a way to alleviate some of these symptoms, and often the stress is part of the root cause, right? Part of that lifestyle. So, and you know, it's really interesting because there's a lot of research on this. So the journal Menopause has great research. This was back in 2017. They showed, they looked at the mindfulness-based stress reduction program, Jon Kabat-Zinn's program, and they showed a direct impact on women's hot flashes. So they significantly went down, and I don't know the stats right now, but the idea was there was a direct correlation and on decreased perceived stress, right? So, wow, engaging in some mindfulness improves hot flashes. Who knew, right? Similarly with sleep, studies have shown that learning how to regulate our nervous system, you know, will help not only help us with countering insomnia, but improve our sleep quality. So again, very, very kind of basic things. All of this is common sense. Problem is, it's not common practice. And I think that's where we all come in as practitioners. We're helping the people we're working with make these things common practice, right? And even things like anxiety, you know, there's research that shows that, you know, for women, anxiety, as the estrogen fluctuates, you know, anxiety can increase. So again, the idea of learning how to breathe, be mindful, be present is really, really important. Now, what I thought I would do a little differently than everybody else is I actually thought we would take a couple of minutes to engage in a micro practice, right? So this is one, and I actually kept thinking about this because I thought I wanted to do something very simple that everybody can take away and do easily and remember to do over and over. I talk to my clients about micro practices, right? The really great thing about micro practices is often if we say we're going to do all these things, and changing lifestyles is very, very difficult, right? Like sometimes it's like, oh my gosh, I can't do it. Or we take on too much and we get overwhelmed and then we don't do it. If you promise to engage in a micro practice and you actually tell someone you're going to do it. So I think we need to commit to each other here. We're going to actually do this on our own at least one time. What ends up happening is you actually get a dopamine hit in the brain. So you actually then feel good that you can do this, right? So you're more likely to do it again and again. And there's a compound effect because as you do this, any of these practices we've talked about today, but especially with the nervous system, as we do it over and over again, right, we're going to create new neural pathways. We're going to become new people, you know, people who are a bit calmer, people who aren't as reactive. You know, what I see with many of my clients is a pen drops and they, you know, they're like, you know, that they're in fight and flight, right? So what we're doing is we're training our body to be a little bit calmer, to be less reactive, to be okay. And there's some little key secrets from our, you know, ancient yogis that we can use that are really simple. So, and I wanted to also say, and we've got this beautiful psychologist, it's very hard to think your way out of stress, right? So sometimes you have to tap into the body. So that's what we're going to do, okay? So I tried to find an acronym because I need acronyms to remember things. So I thought ABC, okay? So A, a line, right? So the spine, I never knew before I did a yoga training about 10 years ago and then I became a yoga therapist. I had no idea how critical the spine is. Our spine is like a superhighway that connects in through our brainstem, actually all the way to our brain and our prefrontal cortex, right? So aligning the spine is really, really important because what ends up happening, think about yourselves, think about your kids, think about your clients, think about anybody. What are we doing all day? We're like this, right? So we are sending a signal to our nervous system that we're not okay, right? This is actually, if you think of someone who's depressed, they're often hunched over. Not only that, in this kind of posture, right, we are cutting off our diaphragm, right? So we can't breathe, right? Anxiety is likely going to be enhanced because we're not able to take a deep, deep, full breath, right? So the first thing we want to do is just align our spine. Kind of imagine yourself growing 3 inches. There's kind of a nice little C curve. What I like to do is pull my shoulders back. I actually exaggerate those shoulders. Imagine your shoulder blades are almost being tucked into jean pockets, right? So we're pulling those shoulders back. We're tucking our chin. The reason is because we want that spine to connect in through our neck right up to our prefrontal cortex and bring it online, right? So we align the spine. B, what we want to do is breathe, right? So we want to first notice our breath. If somebody's got a lot of anxiety, maybe they don't want to focus on the breath and then they want to listen. But let's imagine we're not in trauma, right? So then you just want to notice your breath. Just notice it, right? It's being present. So you notice, you bring attention to your breath. So you may notice cool air coming in through your nose, traveling down into your diaphragm, pausing there. And then as you exhale, you notice it's warm breath. So you want to do that a few times. You notice the cool air coming in, warm air coming out, in and out. And now what you may want to do is you want to count. And what you want to do is you want to exhale to reset the nervous system and put it in that parasympathetic, right, system, which is part of the autonomic nervous system, which is that rest, digest, and detox. Is you exhale for a little bit longer. So we inhale, let's say for 4, and you exhale for 5 or 6. Inhaling for 4, and exhaling for 5. Very simple. When somebody can't sleep at night, right? Often, again, their body is thinking it's in danger. Having an activity for their mind as well, breathing out for a little longer than you're breathing in, right, helps. It's also, you know, it kind of lulls you to sleep because it's a little boring. But again, breathing out for a little longer. Often when we have anxiety, we're breathing up here and with our mouths. We want to breathe with our nose, right? We're signaling our nervous system that we're okay, right? So again, A, align. B, breathe. C, now, I don't always say this to the corporate clients, but I actually, C is chant, okay? Now, I'm going to tell you a little bit about chanting. You don't need to be chanting, oh, num, whatever, right? Making sound, right? Making sound, like even an ah or an a humming sound or a sigh. Ah, what's happening is we're stimulating our vagus nerve. The vagus nerve is this beautiful wandering nerve, and it kind of starts here, wanders through, touches into our organs, crisscrosses at the diaphragm. When we chant or we sing or we hum or we laugh, we are stimulating that vagus nerve, right? So the other thing, what I actually often tell my corporate clients who maybe aren't open to that, many are, is I will say C is calm. Just telling the auto suggestion to tell your body to calm, it will listen. Right, so you'll just say, see, calm. But what we're going to do, and you're all muted, we can actually try a little chant. So inhaling, and you can just, right? Or sigh, inhaling, right? So you're sighing, you're chanting, om, even humming, stimulating that vagus nerve. You're calming that nervous system. you're communicating with that nervous system. And it's simple, right? So like I said earlier, common sense, not common practice. And what I would invite you to do is, again, ABC, align, notice. I ask my clients, I do this myself, every 50 minutes. Every 50 minutes, we should be taking a break, right? Because we have these ultra-DN rhythms. And we don't take enough breaks as women. We don't take enough breaks. We're just going, going, going. So having a practice where you actually stop every so often and take and do the ABCs, aligning, that's fine. Breathing and chanting, or just calming, goes a long way. So yes, I invite you to try this as many times a day as you can, and notice what happens. Notice what happens. Anytime I'm waiting for my water to boil, when I'm making tea, my phone rings, I don't pick it up right away. I do the ABCs. When you're walking into a room, like, nobody needs to know what you're doing. You're just holding that handle before you walk into that room. You align the spine, you take a couple deep breaths and say, calm down. It's quite magical. And we're our best labs, right? So experiment on yourself and see what happens.
Fantastic. Oh my gosh, that was lovely. We've all gone into a bit of a peace space, haven't we? It's lovely. Thank you so much, Monica. Well, just to repeat my name, although I think it's on my window, but Claire George, thehealthhabitscoach.com. So that's the name of my website, The Health Habits Coach. And on there, you can find this. I'm really quite proud of it, actually. I'm gonna do a bit of woohoo. It's called the Woman's in Midlife Revival Guide, and it really is the holistic journey and supports around that for that guide. You know, for that journey. I'm a solo traveler way before I was a woman in menopause. I've traveled from the Amazon to the Himalaya solo. I've worked volunteered in women's, you know, cooperatives, and I'm fascinated by travel and journeying. And to me, a menopause journey is just part of life for a woman, and it's a natural sequence. So that's how I've taken my cue, and the guide is there on my website for you all to get support across daily lifestyle habits, how to rest, how to rejuvenate, how to reset, and how to reinvent yourself for the next phase of your beautiful life. Okay, over with the push and into the thank you so, so much, everybody. This has been amazing, way beyond expectations for me. You know, Simona, Hannah, Monica, and Jeanette, and all of you that have attended or watching this post-recording, thank you so, so much. It is amazing. The more that we talk and have little chats, and find time to think about ourselves, our health as women in midlife, the better for everyone, but most especially as well. You know, I have a 19-year-old daughter, and I just want this situation to be a little bit more supported and available and accessible for her, you know, a couple of decades from now. So thank you so, so much, everyone. It's been brilliant.